The Theosophical Society presents James Perkins in a talk entitled Through Death to Rebirth.
This matter of death is a familiar experience to all of us. It takes only a reflection to realize that we are living amidst death all of the time. The very tissues of our bodies are constantly being repaired. Every moment, every hour of our lives, the cells are dying and being renewed and rebuilt. The body is constantly changing through the process of rebirth amidst death. Similarly, in our emotional worlds, these relationships that we have built so laboriously sometimes, so poignantly sometimes, they are constantly changing, and every now and then the whole thing crashes about our ears to our despair. So our emotional worlds are constantly being reborn. Likewise, our mental worlds. After all, the world itself is only what we think it is. Our mental worlds are constantly changing through death and rebirth. And over a period of years, they certainly do become different worlds. I know that there must be a number of us here tonight who can remember the world of 1912. Could anything be deader than the world of 1912? Only a few years ago, there weren't any television sets. And only a few years before that is to say before 1920, there were no radios. And yet what a new world has been created by these airwaves. Just think for a moment all the singing commercials that are banging through us right now. We don't receive them, thank goodness. But we are being told to wash our clothes with Rinso White and to do something with something that tastes like a cigarette should. And that kind of business. Well, we know we only have to go to the proper instrument, turn the knob, there they are. Our worlds have certainly become different, our outer physical world. Before 1945, there weren't any atoms. At least it was for most of us. We could take them or leave them. Of course, physicists and chemists and scientists and other technicians, they had to do with atoms. But for the rest of us, it didn't make a lot of difference whether we knew anything about them or not, but not now. No intelligent person can afford not to inform himself about the nature of the atom, not only the atoms, but the particles in the atoms, neutrons, protons, electrons. We'd better know something about it in view of the peril that overhangs us this very night and every living person on this planet. We have to have informed views about these matters. And so there is this constant dying and rebirth. And we ought to connect the two, death and rebirth. For death is the other side of rebirth. We die to be reborn. We die from the child to become the youth. From the youth to the matured adult. From the adult into that old age period. And yet there is a continuity of consciousness. We are satisfied, aren't we, that we were there in that baby body as we are here now. So there is this identity of being, and identity seems to be what really matters. Now, I say, if we could translate this experience of identity to that level of consciousness within that is imperishable and that survives all changes, including the dissolution of the physical body, we are then in a state of mind prepared to understand reincarnation. If we can observe with detachment the life and death of our bodies, we can catch a glimpse of our immortality now. Now, in order to understand what we really are, we have to look at ourselves right side up, as I said Thursday night. We have been taught to regard ourselves first and foremost as the physical body, and for many people that is the be-all and end-all of existence. The physical body And then, of course, we may have a soul, some tell us, and as for the spirit, we have to find out in some future experience. However, if we are to regard ourselves with reality, we must consider ourselves as imperishable spirits, sons of God who are dwelling in immortal bodies that do not die the soul. The immortal soul that is growing through a long series of experiences that it is having in a series of incarnations in human forms. And so the situation is, as St. Paul said, man is spirit, soul, and body. The cycle of life does not begin with the birth of the baby. It begins in the soul, from that central intelligence which radiates forth through its vehicles, mental, emotional, physical, to the outer perimeter, which is the physical, and there it dwells for 50, 60, 70 years or so, and then begins receding inward through a purgation period, which means disenthrallment from its entanglement in physical matter and the physical aspect of living, on inward to become absorbed in the heaven world, where it is absorbing its experience of the past, and then to return in some 800, 1,000, or 1,500 years to a new cycle, a reincarnation. That is the process in a word. We don't die from the physical plane to, quote, go to heaven, unquote. We come forth from the soul into these three coats of skin to labor and endure and struggle for mastery of environment and self, and then to return to the source. The center is there, not here. And it is the physical life, the perimeter, the earth, that is the bourne from which all travelers return. Now, I say we are using these three coats of skin simultaneously right now, all of us. We are using the physical body, that's obvious. We are using the emotional body whenever we are feeling, whatever we are feeling. Consciousness focused at that energy level is feeling. Focused at a still higher energy level is thinking in the mental body. And so we are evolving these three bodies. Now, there's no question, I believe, about the evolution of the physical body. But there is also the individual evolution of the emotional body and of the mental body. Each one of us is evolving his own individual, emotional, and mental body. If we look around us in the world, we can see in some primitive conditions that a top cultural event might well be a wild tribal dance around some jungle fire. Whereas in our midst, a top cultural event would probably be a dignified audience listening to a symphony, listening to Myra Hess play the piano, or it might well be a gathering of serious-minded people such as this enjoying a metaphysical discussion. Now, I say that this is evidence of emotional and mental evolution individually, not racially. Now, there's no understanding of this or no accounting for it in our general evolutional theory, scientific that is, because there is not enough time provided for any such development. We do not take into account the amount of time that is needed for the evolution of the soul's equipment. For instance, we need to consider if there is the evolution of the individual, emotional, and mental body, that this process of reincarnation is true, and it takes a long span of time. If you look at your last life, people such as us, cultivated people, educated people, people living spiritual lives, the search for truth, if you look at your last life, you're thinking of 1,000 years ago, perhaps. The next life, 1,000 years hence. So that this life is in immediate contact with your past life and your future life to come, and you have one span there of 2,000 years. You'd only need a few of these to take care of all recorded time, and you'd be back in the Stone Age. Not nearly enough time. I heard a famous anthropologist on the radio the other night speaking of a man's span of existence on this physical plane. He estimated it at 500,000 years. Now civilization has taken some 8 or 10,000 years according to recorded history. So that you have some 490,000 years that man has spent crawling through an animal existence to produce suddenly high stages of civilization all over the world, as we have evidence of there having been. And so we have this situation. Do you really think it is that way? We need all of that 490,000 years and millions more besides for the cycles of reincarnation that are necessary for the evolution of the innumerable nations, civilizations, and cultures that must rise and fall, through which individuals must pass to evolve and unfold the complications of a Shakespeare, of a Leonardo da Vinci, of an Albert Einstein. Now it seems perpetually odd to me how the various sciences inquire into the most minute operations in this physical world, as far removed from everyday life as it seems possible to get. I mean the private life of a microbe, the love life of a molecule, and such things, but death. This universal human experience is given no laboratory attention beyond the physical dissolution of the body. And why? Why? Because the approach to truth that is the way of modern exact science must weigh, measure, and observe only that which can be registered by our sensory equipment. All knowledge, the knowledge of modern exact science, is sensate knowledge. And it rests upon the assumption that reality is perceived by the brain and sensory apparatus only. Therefore, when this equipment perishes, there is nothing beyond that. When you're dead, you're dead. And yet, to think of death, even as a materialist, in the light of present-day knowledge, seems to me to require that we postulate the survival of consciousness, a unit of consciousness that continues on, a soul, if you will. Have you ever performed the imaginative exercise of sitting quietly, contemplating the physical body and its processes, exploring it with your knowledge of physiology, biology, chemistry, physics, the ordinary common knowledge? If thus you might be sitting one afternoon quietly thinking in these terms of your physical equipment, you might pass swiftly over the exterior of the body in your imagination and then let consciousness sink through the skin, through the dermis and epidermis and on inward, past the little nerve endings and blood vessels into the world of muscles and bones and organs. And there, behold, the marvelous organization of the physical body, using your imagination and your knowledge. And thus one might examine the bloodstream, this tide of life with its vital functions, and go on to explore methodically the wonderful nervous system and the glandular apparatus. And then, by turning on a new power, the power of magnification, he might journey into the commonwealth of the cells. These billions of little body builders, bone cells, brain cells, muscle cells, a whole separate stream of evolution, says the theosophist. Now, if he will continue to become smaller and smaller, he might focus his observations within the walls of a single cell, and seeing the jelly-like substance stretching in the distances in all directions. And as he sharpens his focus, the very substance becomes ever more tenuous, pulling apart into clusters of little pinpoint lights like stars in a galaxy with widening air spaces between them. And these little clusters are becoming a fireworks display of the molecules of the chemical elements. And so plunging on downwards into the world of molecules and atoms, All semblance of matter as we know it and recognize it has ended. And there one might come to journey's end in a single hydrogen atom, in this frontier region of the physical world of matter. And there we might register the single greatest impression playing upon us. What is it? Just empty space. And yet not nothing, for the walls of the atom, a spherical space pushed back, charged with the whirling waves of the electrons moving at tremendous velocities, while in the central nucleus there are flames and flashes, a fiery vortex of electrical forces that we have given the names protons, neutrons, positrons, mesons, and so forth, 21 or more of them. Here we have then life appearing into the physical world and disappearing into those invisible realms beyond. And that is all there is. And so vast is the space, the emptiness, that if we try to compare it in terms that we might use for comparison, we would have to think, for example, of that planetarium building down in Chicago as the central nucleus of the hydrogen atom. If it were, you would have to think of an orange, mind you, an orange, flying out over the central part of Hudson's Bay, down around Nova Scotia, Key West, Florida, around up through San Antonio, Texas, and Billings, Montana, and back around Hudson's Bay and so forth. An orange, all the rest empty space. But the electron, of course, is not a particle like an orange. It's a wave. But some evidence shows that it must be a particle. Therefore, it's a wavicle. Nobody knows. Now, looking outward from this atomic observation point, where now is solid reality, solid matter, the reality of the materialists? In the world of atoms, you cannot find any ultimate particles of substance, no physical building blocks, so to speak, of the world around us. Atoms, these atoms of empty space, are flashing into this arena of the physical body from surrounding space, atoms of oxygen, of hydrogen, of nitrogen, and so on. And the observer, bewildered as he must well be, must ask, what magic holds this fantastic universe together? This universe of myriads of such atoms, each one a solar system, myriads of molecules, each one a little galaxy of atoms, cells, tissues, organs, nerves, bones, skin. What holds all of this into a perfectly integrated, mobile, and smoothly functioning organism? What, I ask you, but a persisting, rhythmic continuity of consciousness? A unit of consciousness, a soul, if you will. How can the materialist do without postulating this mysterious self-consciousness apparatus as the primary principle? How can it? It is units of consciousness evolving. Now what we call death is the final withdrawal of this principle of consciousness. The tissues go on dissolving like they always have been doing, only more swiftly now, and they're not being rebuilt. The elements are breaking up into molecules, and the atoms are beginning to fly apart into other combinations, new organisms perhaps, that are alive because another unit of consciousness is there holding that thing together. And so there in one direction we see dissolving the substance of physical matter, where in the other direction disappears the unit of consciousness. Does it also dissolve? Has it lost its identity? Has it disappeared? Can we follow it? Now it is at this point that I want to say that theosophy is here to dispel this barbaric notion that nothing can be known about death. And since every one of us will most certainly pass through this experience, this transition we call death, it would seem only reasonable, wouldn't it, that we possess ourselves of all available knowledge that makes sense to us. I think, of course, that theosophy makes a lot of sense about this matter. And so, as men who set forth to explore strange shores and frontiers, study maps, gather information, even make plans, even train themselves. I ask, why shouldn't we do so with regard to the great adventure that lies ahead for every one of us, this passage through the experience called death? The information that science has for us goes no further than the breaking up of the physical body. But there does exist an authentic knowledge. There do exist maps. There are theosophical maps of the realms that we shall enter. There is a body of knowledge that has been accumulated from many sources throughout the ages in using many ways for gathering this knowledge, including the use of supernormal powers such as clairvoyance, such as the powers latent in the soul to release oneself from the physical body consciously, to project consciousness elsewhere to obtain information. With these and many other awakened powers that are latent in all of us and will in due time become fully awakened, with these and the awakened intuitive spiritual perception, knowledge has been obtained, organized, and taught as the ancient wisdom of humanity, specifically in the ancient mystery schools that have existed for ages of time up until about 2,000 years ago. Now, using the map which theosophy has provided for us for a quick glimpse at what lies ahead, let us have such a glimpse and then proceed to take up considerations about our passage through this experience. For example, using the map, we see first when we withdraw from the physical body, we are in that atomic sheath that I spoke of the other night, which theosophists have named specifically the etheric double, a rarefied physical matter through which channels the vital forces that keep the physical body alive. Every nerve, every tissue, every cell is encased in this etheric or atomic matter, if you will, through which is coursing the vitality, the prana, as you may have heard the technical term given, the prana, which is the vital force flowing through the physical body, keeping it healthy and alive and normally balanced. Now, this etheric body, we should release ourselves from it once and pass on into the next realm. Sometimes that doesn't happen. I'm coming back to that. But in the next realm, we are in that body which the theosophists term astral. Astral meaning luminous, starry when seen clairvoyantly, and that's why the name was chosen, astral. There we are in a world of finer matter. We enter that at death. It is a place through which we are disentangling ourselves from the physical attractions and various entanglements we have gotten into. And so we pass through that for a period of time to enter the mental world, which is the heaven world. And we are there for an extended period of time. We pass through that, and then we're in the home of the soul and come back into incarnation through the process called reincarnation. So I say, now that's a quick glimpse at the path that lies ahead of us, and we are now ready to consider this matter of dying. I want to make first this observation. We do not enter a strange new life at the time of death. We experience rather a continuation of the present life. Dying is very much the same experience as that we have long been familiar with in going to sleep. Going to sleep and dying are exactly the same thing, except that the dead do not re-enter the body. Whereas the living you goes out onto the astral plane at night, into that astral world, and returns from it in the morning, having no memory of the experience, unless we might have recaptured something in what we call dreams. We are returned, whereas that takes place with the living, those who have left their physical bodies finally at death merely remain in the astral world. That's the first consideration. You've been there lots of times. You're back again, and you're going to go there permanently at death. That is, permanently for the rest of this incarnation. Now, my second observation. Death is not painful. Now, the approach to it, of course, may be painful. We have plenty of evidence of that. But the actual departure is not the so-called death agony, last struggle, agonizing departure, and all that dramatization by people who are always crying, woe this and woe that. Normally, when we are dying, we find our extremities growing cold and we are unable to move them because consciousness is coming toward the heart, and there it gathers and passes on into the head region when there is a moment of quiet, and we should be quiet and permit those who are passing through this stage to be quiet. Because at that moment there is a rapid review of the whole of life, and when this takes place, the entire vibratory capacity of this physical vehicle is stamped on one permanent atom. All the other atoms leave, but one. One atom remains with the soul. Now, this is part of the reincarnating apparatus. Now, the soul steps out of the physical body. The man does. And there he's in his etheric sheath. Everything's just the same. Pictures on the wall, furniture there, body lying on the bed, friends standing about. Nothing to fear about death. Science and loving thoughtfulness have reduced pain to a minimum, and the actual transition is a happy one, as many have testified to. It ought to be revealing that usually the dying person's face relaxes and he smiles. As one dies, the immediate sensation is that of freedom, of lightness, of buoyancy. But if one tries to speak to his friends, they don't hear him. Tries to touch them, they don't feel it. Because consciousness at that moment is operating in a finer matter, a swifter vibration. This might be disconcerting, except that attention is elsewhere. Friends and relatives have come, those who have passed on into the other worlds before this, they come to this deathbed scene. A guardian angel that may have been helping us all the time is standing there. Perhaps if we've had great aspiration towards some great teacher, he too is present. And so the experience is up, drawing us up into the light. Usually at death, one stands aside from his body, little believing in death. There is full awareness coupled with awe and curiosity. There's a joyousness about death, if one is ready. Suppose you were dying on a bed of pain and suddenly became aware of being not only on that bed, but simultaneously walking lightheartedly across some upland meadow, say in the Alps in summertime. A warm sun shining, a light breeze blowing, and all the wonder and beauty of nature, and your whole being thrilling with this rapture of the prospect of color and music and fragrance, a singing unity. And suppose that by merely imagining you could have anything you required, and moreover, that here you discovered old friends and loved ones gone these many years, would you want to come back? I think not. Your greatest desire would be to make every moment count in calling out of your inner being the power of love. Your most earnest effort would be the purifying of all that is coarse and unclean and selfish, yes, and hateful, to enter more and more into this glorious life of inner being. So we leave the physical body. It drops away. We're standing there in the etheric, I say. The passage through it should be swift. But sometimes it isn't. Why? Because we're clinging to what we left behind. We ought to know we can't take it with us, but some people keep trying to do so. So there we are, trying to cling to what we have left behind. We mustn't do that. The way to die is to die confidently, to go straight forward into the light, look upward to that which you aspire, to the object of your devotion, and walk straight into the light, leaving this world with a loving au revoir. A blessing upon those left behind. They're the ones who need it. And the result of this relaxed condition is sleep. You drop asleep to awaken in your place in the astral world. That region which our spiritualist friends have referred to as a summer land. A very good name, I think, because there your dearest wishes, your unfulfilled desires that you never had a chance to fulfill in this heavy world, there you are able to fulfill them. It's a place of accelerating consciousness. Remember, you're letting go the heaviness and the denseness of the life down here in this world. Sometimes the desires are earthy. It takes a little longer time to shake loose from them. But usually they're just mediocre. And we're stepping up our existence. We're accelerating our consciousness. Don't forget that the astral plane is a place where you can create readily. What a wonderful place for the imaginative person, for the artist. I'm going to have a very good time on the astral plane when I reach there, because it'll be so easy to create in many ways that you feel here such obstructions, so difficult to do anything. We're such creatures of habit. We have to change ourselves when we get there, using imagination and will. But we're such creatures of habit. You know, there are people who pass away who have been crippled here on this earth, say, and for years have been hobbling around on crutches. They go right along hobbling on crutches on the astral plane till somebody says, look, you don't need those. Throw them away. Look, you've got two legs. And they look, and sure enough, they've got two legs. You don't even have to walk. How do you go? You visualize, you desire will, and you're there, just like that. We have to change. We have to adapt ourselves to the new worlds we're entering, and so release the powers that are already there in us. It's very difficult to believe we have many powers that we shall know and use constantly on the astral plane. And so we are growing upward from one group to another through cultural bodies, school after school, learning to serve more purely, more beautifully, learning to be with unselfish motivation. What a change from down here, huh? There we are learning. There we are moving upward, astral level by level, into a more radiant, etherealized existence. Now this person has been on the astral plane some 10 years, maybe even 20 years. It's normal to be there even 25 years. Of course, there are some we've found souls that are there for longer than that. But within that time, the normal course is that one has passed through this transition and is ready to fall asleep again. This is the second death that we hear about. We fall asleep again getting ready to enter the heaven world. Now let's leave this person at this point and turn backward to consider some of the cases that are less fortunate, the earthbound cases as they are referred to. Here we have the earthbound materialist, for example. He isn't released from that etheric half world, that gray, heavy, uncomfortable place, because he's trying to hold back to all of the things that he knew here. And everything on the physical plane has its counterpart in that etheric world. It isn't a place of pain necessarily. It's just an uncomfortable, unhappy, more or less dreary existence of loneliness. And I think this whole Bridie Murphy thing belongs in that category. To see that poor old lady wandering around in that gray world trying to speak to her husband and her friends and trying to wonder where she is, and nobody ever talks to her. That's typically earthbound in the etheric double, I would say. Whatever that thing was that came through Ruth Simmons, that is an account of an earthbound entity. And nothing of beauty and wonder and glory in that. And I should think that any sensitive person, anyone with sensibilities, anyone who knows that the truth is beautiful and glorious and wonderful must certainly be repelled by that account of reincarnation. It isn't good enough, friends. So we have this earthbound person. Here he is, a materialist, and as I say, he's lonely. He's trying to get someone to talk to him, usually. He's trying to get things to happen that used to happen. Usually, he can't be convinced that he's dead. He's in a world where the physical objects have their counterpart, but he's unable at first to see the difference. And yet, puzzling things are happening to him. He speaks to his friends, and they don't answer. He may, after a while, carefully and considerately come to the conclusion that he must be crazy. He'll have to admit now that there is life beyond the grave, but he'll say, certainly there's nothing beyond this. Nothing. He can't see it anywhere. In his craving for his earthly existence, if it's great enough, he may try to get back into a physical body, and that's where he gets into real trouble. So this earthbound person needs to know where he is. He needs to know what is going on. He needs a sense of direction, which is up into those etherealization experiences. There he sees the people around him, his relatives weeping at the time of his death. He tries to tell them, I'm not dead. They won't listen to him. He may go to his funeral. Many of them do. And sometimes this is probably a good thing because he takes part in this very impressive procession. He listens to the eulogies. A man never heard so many good things about himself, nor had so many flowers given to him. You know, it wouldn't, all this fuss and pageantry that he takes part in usually can convince anybody that he must be, if you'll pardon the word, dead. Of course, if he hangs around long enough, he's going to begin to hear some less complimentary things, and especially if he had property and he left a will to his relatives. It'd be a good thing if he got away from there. Well, fortunately, even the materialistically minded soon lose interest in trying to contact conditions here, and they turn away. They are helped to turn toward the astral world, toward the normal process, toward their friends they'll find there, toward relations that have passed on ahead of them. And so, with an awakened interest, they begin to wake up to their normal progress and go on inward. Now let's turn to another of these earthbound conditions, much less fortunate. Those who go out hating violently, thirsting for revenge, fearfully resentful as those who are slain by what we call capital punishment. Whenever we thrust people out onto the astral plane without love, they are confused, they are bewildered, and they're in this gray, heavy whirl, violently trying to get back to where they were. And so it is, too, with criminals who are killed in the midst of their crime. They are trying to continue what they were doing. They make these attempts to do so. Naturally, They move toward places of iniquity, to dens of vice, to wherever people are indulging in an excess of self-indulgence. There they got some kind of a vicarious participation in this evil process that's going on, and so they cling to these people in their auras, so to say, and people who go in such places are likely to come away with such beings strung around them in their atmosphere. That's why some of these people who dwell in such places are very unpleasant creatures to be around. They have unpleasant associates on the astral plane. Now, these people need to be helped. And if we were more intelligent about our criminal people, we would be careful not to send them out onto the astral plane violently so that they can continue their depredations where we've lost all track of their activities. We would see to it that the criminal is incarcerated and trained to become a more constructive member of society in order to protect society. It's the harder way, but it's the only way. And the mentally and emotionally ill should be institutionalized and given care. Now there is the sad plight of the suicide. He has found his condition to be more than he could cope with, and so he has, in despair, taken his life. Now the natural span of a person's life is fixed by the soul, the ego, before he comes into incarnation. Suppose it is that long. And this personality takes it upon himself to end it, say, here. What happens to the rest of the incarnation? There he is in that gray world. Still physical, if you will, but invisible. And he is driven by the motivations that prompted him to this unfortunate action. So round and round he goes in this cycle. And driven by the pain and unnecessary worry and suffering he has visited upon others, he'll find his condition intolerable, infinitely worse than any depressed condition he may have been in that drove him in the first place to this act. Fortunately for these people, there are helpers. And these helpers, on the other side, are trying to quiet this person and to bring an atmosphere of harmony about him so that he can awaken for a moment to his downpouring soul, or I should say his out-radiating soul, which is caught in this vibration, you see, of fierce and intent motivation toward action. Action of that kind, deprive him of existence. Now also, fortunately, we down here on this plane can be of great help to such a person. And it's a good thing to know that we, with our knowledge, can surround this person with light, with our emotional power, can surround him with harmony and love and good will, and with our inner spiritual will, can call down the divine powers to awaken this poor soul to his natural course of existence. And so to release him from this driving continuation and repetition of the initial experience of suicide. We can help these people thus with our prayers and our thought, and helped from below and from above, they become relaxed, they fall asleep, and then they awaken in their place in the astral plane to go on upward along the normal course into the concluding periods of their incarnation. Now there's another of these unusual cases I think we ought to consider before we complete this listing, and that is sudden death by violence. There is so much of it in these days. It may happen to any one of us at any time. And perhaps everyone here knows someone or has had someone in his immediate family who has met this condition. There are many cases to prove that the actual going is painless. I want to say that I have myself passed through this experience in several ways in this very lifetime, and I'd like to refer to the most dramatic incident in my life in order to throw some light on what I'm trying to say here. About 8 years ago, I was walking along a country highway. It was in the middle of the day, the sun was shining, the wind was blowing lightly, there was no traffic. I was in deep thought, in meditation, feeling the joyous rapport with nature all around me, perfectly attuned to the inner being of happiness. And while I was walking along in this condition, there was approaching swiftly behind me on the road an automobile with the driver asleep at the wheel. And this car was steadily crossing over the other side of the road and out onto the shoulder, and it came swiftly toward me, and I, without the slightest premonition that anything was coming, with no thought whatsoever of fear, no time for any fear, this car smashed into me from the rear with a terrific impact, crushing my legs and hurling me forward through the air to land on my head and tear it wide open on that pavement. There I was, dead to this world for all practical purposes. And those who came in the police ambulance to take what was left to the hospital must have gazed upon this condition thinking, poor fella, what pain he must have suffered. Now, I'm saying all this to tell you, there was no pain. There was no break in consciousness. There was continuous consciousness. I had been intense in my abstract awareness of the beauty and joy of life, and here suddenly, in my intensity of consciousness, all individuality itself disappeared in a boundlessness, in a universality of being of no limitations, of an allness that was a shoreless ocean of light. And I dwelt therein, in the same complete identity that I have right this moment. Now, there was no confusion, no bewilderment, only the clearest of the clear, the surest of the sure, where death was not. Now, there was an awareness that something had happened. I no longer had a heavy body. I couldn't have cared less. I was awake in a universe of forces. I was aware that this was a flowing life of God. I could see that every living thing was anchored down here on this physical plane, had gone through this long, long course of evolution to build an anchorage, a fulcrum here on the physical plane, to transmit the life of God all the way down to the physical plane and radiate it in this world. Every flower, every living plant, every animal, every man is singing this message of God in his inmost self right now, though we may not be aware of it in our brains. That is the divine life flowing through us and flowing through everything around us. And to become aware of it is to know the oneness of all life. There is but one life in all things, a true foundation for universal brotherhood. And so there I was. My consciousness was focused there. I could come down into the physical body, give orders, but I would go back where I was focused, in that realm of existence. And so I dwelt there for some days. And I could see, I had a great realization there, that man cannot live completely yet in that ocean of bliss, the bliss of God, in this ocean of universal love that is called the cosmic Christ consciousness, until he has awakened it fully down here. And how is he doing that? Through every relationship that he has, through our associates, through our loved ones, through everything that we are related to, we are being awakened in some aspect of this inmost being. And we are learning how to pour it out of ourselves to the world around us. And so, how dear then is every relationship that we have with our friends, with our relatives, with our families. For in each one of these, we are learning to release that cosmic consciousness. And we return, life after life, changing these relationships. Even the people that become or seem to be our hateful enemies become our loving and wonderful friends who taught us as no one else could have taught us in those past lives. And as we grow on to the fullness of the awakening of this divine consciousness within us, all become loving identities of being, a oneness of a whole of life. And so the immortal soul is growing and unfolding the statue of Godhood down here, and it has to be here. We are earning and unfolding immortality here. Now, after some days, 5 days to be exact, I watched the process of return. I saw that life consciousness was focusing down here in this physical body with an attraction that has been referred to as thirst. That's a very good name for it, thirst. The thirst for sentient existence. And that thing is as inexorable as the power that takes the water flowing over Niagara Falls. It cannot be resisted. And so I was drawn down through the mental body into the astral body, into the physical brain. And there, the blackout. Just like that. I tell you, for days, for months, I couldn't hardly motivate myself to go on living because we are so completely deluded in this wrapped around blanket of physical flesh. So deluded as to what is reality. And so I existed then again in this body of pain. And I had a long time to look at it. Which is the body of life? Which is the body of death? Well, friends, now we have considered these several abnormal cases, let us return to that normal course we had with the person who was in the astral plane, had reached the topmost peak of it, was falling asleep in what we call the second death. Now he awakens. He awakens to the most beautiful, the longest, the inspiring part of this journey, the conclusion of this true story in the closing chapter of the cycle, the life cycle in the heaven world. I tell you that heaven is inevitable. Everybody goes to heaven sooner or later, not everything. You can't take your passion for peanuts and vanilla wafers and the smoking of Lucky Strike cigarettes. But you pass from this astral world, taking with you into the heaven world all that can live there, all that can exist in the heaven world. The sleeper awakens there with his whole being suffused with light and harmony. All connection with the physical world, with evil and sorrow and difference, all cut off now. The main characteristic, intense bliss of the perfect unity of life and love. Understanding through love, knowledge deepening into wisdom. Each one is taken there, everything that can live there, the beautiful, the true, and the good, and there in profound contemplation, he reviews this to draw out its essence, the meaning of it all, and is translating his experience into innate faculty and character. How can the human being help but constantly grow better and better and finer, because he keeps sifting out all the evil and holding on to the little good, whatever it was, and then to the more and more good, and finally to a whole lot of good. He's growing ever more swiftly toward perfection. It can be seen now that we lay up treasures in heaven by the breadth and depth of our interest while we are on earth, by what we revere, by what we aspire to do and be, by our yearning and striving to play and sing and create, by the many and varied contacts that we make. Our friends and loved ones are there in their noblest aspects too, in that heaven world, for only the soul shows up there with all of its wonder and glory. And we know each other as we really are, not as we have shown ourselves to be down here in a very limited and ugly edition, comparatively ugly. The length of time spent in heaven necessarily depends upon the spiritual content of the richness of effort we've made here, of the experience, spiritual experience, while here on earth. All of this is metamorphosed into innate faculty, tendency, character, being, which we are going to bring back with us. Now, all of this is stamped on that one permanent mental atom, just as has been stamped on the emotional atom and on the physical atom as we leave each world. We come then to the end of this heaven existence. Now, we've been there for 1,000 years, let us say. We have completed the entire cycle of incarnation. Now we are withdrawing into the eternal aspects of the soul, into contact with the imperishable God within. We re-enter the home that is beyond heaven, the true paradise of the Spirit, and know ourselves as the gods we are, one with the Father. Now we can look forward and backward throughout time. We can see the vision of that which is to be, and determine our part in it, and so prepare for the return to life. Here we can perceive what death really is, not the loss of the body, the loss of spiritual freedom. Not the loss of life, but the loss of freedom to think and be. Death is a slowed down consciousness that is due to the limitations we have created around the awakening spirit. Death is spirit blinded by matter. Death is hate where love might have been. Death is a paralysis of fear where courage and joy should reign. So I say from these heights, in this inner world of the soul, we thirst for a plunge into matter. We gather our forces to try out the spirit again in the fires below. And how otherwise may we prove the divine self within us and release the real amidst the illusion? How may we otherwise become masters of life and death than by plunging into this abyss of forgetfulness? where all can be dark, and yet we must see the light. Where all can be despair, and yet we must have indomitable courage. Where all is cynicism and negation so often, and yet we must know what we know. Where all can be overcome by fear and weakness, and yet we have steadfast purpose. Where everything is change, we know our changeless being. Thus to perceive death and rebirth is to take on the sense, the awareness of immortality now. The soul, now refreshed with vision, is prepared to move outward once more from its egoic center into a new cycle of incarnation. And it is from this moment that reincarnation commences and the process of rebuilding the body sets into motion. Now, that mental permanent atom is activated again, vibrated, it draws about it the mental atoms, magnetically draws them, the mental atoms, it creates a mental body, that create a mental body exactly as the one we had before. Potentially, it has to be reawakened by the experiences down here. But all of the potentials that were there before are there again, can be awakened just exactly as it was. Then down into the astral body of permanent atom is activated, magnetically draws all the atoms about it to create again, to recreate the emotional body just as it was before, potentially. Then the little baby body is being born from the mother's womb, and there in that mother's womb, that body is being built physically according to the etheric shell or duplicate that is put there as a kind of a blueprint. That has come from the past, too. You see, a new element has been introduced. Not only is the physical permanent atom reactivated, drawing the physical atoms about it to build this little physical body again with all the potentials that were there from evolution before, but there is this other factor there now of karma. What have we done in the past to limit our coming condition? That plays upon this. It is there in the etheric double, and so the physical body is built according to the pattern created in the past. And we may come into this body limited by being crippled, limited in some other way, or we may come into it with a perfectly wonderful physical body because we have earned that kind of a condition for this present life. And so we are encased in, submerged in, the physical body and all memory blotted out. Now you see why we do not normally remember our past. We have a new mental body. We have a new emotional body. We have a new brain and heredity. And in this 20th century, the mentalities have been consistently and relentlessly impressed with contrary beliefs to what I've been saying here this evening. And it is only when in some flash of intuition there bursts upon us from the soul some light of our inner immortality that we recollect something of our real selves, that we recollect as more than a hope, the truth, that we shall win free of this limitation forever. Liberated, not saved, not some pinnacle of salvation that sets us apart from everyone else, but liberated straight into the heart of all, where there is naught that we do not at one ourselves with, nothing that we cannot know and understand and identify as some fragment of our eternal being. That's what comes to pass at last. Not salvation, but liberation.